Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 307. Thank you very much for all the love for last week's episode with Carl Pilkington and for the Films of the Year episode that kicked the year off, which leads us on to this one, because today's episode is with the Safdie brothers and their pair of brothers who write and direct and act. And one of their films, Uncut Gems, was in my Films of the Year list and was one of the ones I put forward as, you know, it's the top five of the top 16, if not the number one. Maybe the top three, maybe the number one, who knows. But it's a fantastic film, and it's in limited cinemas in the UK now, including the Prince Charles Cinema, which is my favourite cinema in London. I have an episode way back in like the first 20 or 30 episodes that was with Paul Vickery, who runs the Prince Charles and has run it there for a long time. So that's worth going and have a look. But it's on Netflix on January 31st. Their other film, their most easily accessible other film or easily available is Good Time, and that's also on Netflix, and it's fantastic. But as I said in the Films of the Year podcast, Uncut Gems is really one. If you can catch it in the cinema, I really urge you to do so. It was a physical experience for me to watch the music, having that huge cinema sound system build the tension. It's quite all of their films are quite frantic, as we talk about. I mean, we talk about it a lot here, but I really enjoyed talking to these guys. I'm a big fan of their work. It's exciting to see what's ahead for them. It feels there's some really beautiful. This was a really inspirational chat for me personally, as an actor and as a writer, because there's just some bits on it. You'll hear at the end the kind of the path to making this film, whilst it may have felt like it had hurdles in the way and roadblocks, turns out it's the exact path it needed it to be for it to be as amazing a film as it is. So anyway, I won't ramble on too much. As ever, I'm losing my voice a little bit, so apologies for that. As ever, speechdevelopmentrecords.com is where you can buy my music. We've got vinyl at the moment, my live shows, all sorts of stuff, and merch, sunglasses, hoodies, loads of we may not be for you and that's fine merch. So yeah, head over there, patreon.com/scroobiuspip if you're into that kind of thing. But for now, this is Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 307, with the Safdie brothers. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
Hello.
How's it going, guys?
Sorry, I thought it was somebody was coming in there.
No.
I didn't mean to keep you waiting.
Good to meet you. How's it going?
It's good.
Enjoying it all?
Yes, it's a lot, but it's good. People are excited.
Yeah, it's an intense one, right? I've sat down already before. Hello. How's it going? Nice to meet you, Pip.
Nice to meet you, Pip.
How's it all going?
All right.
I've started rolling.
Oh, okay.
So I can jump straight.
Great.
If that's okay,
that's
with you
fine.
Guys. But yeah, but how are you finding it all? Is it an intense run in London?
Yeah, it's very short. Yeah. We landed yesterday and we're leaving tomorrow morning. So
it's a shame because I like coming here. You want to have a little bit more time,
yeah,
just to see the city.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
Just like walking around for like 30 seconds, like oh my god, there's a lot of history here.
Yeah,
five seconds.
When I used to tour in music and that, New York took me at least 4 tours to get my head around any of it, because you're there again. It's that similar thing. You're in hotels,
yeah.
And you're going, oh, I need to go
for sure
to a specific diner or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not really taking anything.
Yeah.
So it can be intense. Well, it's great to have you both. I should introduce. I'm joined by Benny and Joss Safdie. Some of my listeners get annoyed that if I have writers or directors on that I'm a fan of, I'll always mention that I'm an actor, and often mention that I came from 10 years as a rapper into acting. But I'm bringing it up at the start now because I need to tell you about my Sundays. I torture myself on Sundays.
Uh-huh.
I go down these IMDb rabbit holes mm-hmm. and look at writers and the directors and casting directors that have made shit that I think is amazing
uh-huh.
and I want to work with.
Yes.
So you guys had made it onto that a list with Good Time.
Oh, thank you.
But then I walked out of Uncut Gems and the first thing I did was move you guys up to the top of that list because it's such a... particularly in the cinema, it's such an experience of a film. It kind uh-huh. of washes over you in such a heavy manner. How's it been getting it out there to people and getting what seems to be an overwhelmingly positive reaction?
The thing is, what's cool about it is we spent so much time getting to this movie,
yeah.
you know, and learning how to do certain things. And you think like, okay, if we do this in this particular moment in the movie, it's going to affect people that way. And then when you watch it with an audience, everybody feels it at that moment. You're like, oh, my God, I can't believe that worked. You know, it's
it's been, you know, you spend 10 years working on something that, you know, when you start to see it out in the real world, it's interfacing with people. It was a drug for us over the past 10 years. And it's cool to see people have a narcotic reaction with it.
Yeah.
You know, to me, the thriller element of it, the tension, like the part that makes people lean towards the edge of their seats is something that we kind of, worked and educated ourselves on with Good Time. So it wasn't like it was that experience is that fulfilling. Of course, it is on this, but it wasn't the thing that we were looking for. The thing that's most satisfying for us is the humor.
Yeah.
You know, like seeing people being in an audience. I've watched it with two audiences now, feeling everyone move towards the edge of their seat, but hearing the laughter.
Yeah.
Hearing people laughing throughout the movie at really strange times when people might not necessarily laugh. That to me has been like. That's been pretty great because, you know, you can't fake laughter.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I'm in some rep house movie theaters and you hear people like forcing the laugh or giving like their snooty laughs.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hate that. And I hate when people laugh ironically, but real genuine laughter is cool. And it's cool to hear. I mean, obviously not everyone finds this movie funny, but it is cool to see that the humor is hitting because we did write it with that idea. And that's why we cast Sandler to some extent.
Again, I mean, that's what's amazing. Equally, at the start of the year, I didn't expect to have an Adam Sandler film in my films of the year.
Yeah.
And that's not anything against Adam. I think what he does is amazing. But I get annoyed sometimes with my film of the year list if I'm short on blockbusters uh-huh. or on comedies because it's easy to
totally,
fall
yeah.
down that art house route. And I don't want to have this fucking hipster films of the year list. I was literally talking to a mate about it last night. This year, there's so many smaller films that are just blowing me away. So how was that to bring Adam Sandler on board? And again, I think the thing that's beautiful about it is you've not avoided laughter, as you said. It'd be mm-hmm. easy to go, oh, we're getting Adam to do one of his dramatic
turns.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's like, no, you're doing both.
Because that's the thing. Is like when you do – because the thing is like there's a certain type of comedian who is so in touch with themselves and the tragedy of their lives. Or like, and you kind of using their – I guess their experiences at such a close level that they're in tune with that. So Sandler, we knew, could access his life in that way, but we also didn't want to abandon the stuff we loved about him. You know,
yeah, of course.
We really wanted to make a movie that embraced who he was and all of his skills in the best way. And to see him just change so many times, like when he's in the showroom, he's one way. He's got this kind of sing-songy voice, which he picked up from following jewelers and see how they sell. When he's in his back room, he's just total brass tacks, New Yorker, and you know. And then when he's at home, he's a little bit more caring and loving. You know, it's awesome to see him. And the thing is, I have the same thing where you don't want to get so caught up in this high-minded view of what movies are. So you do want to be open to them because the truth is, you can have an independent film made at a $200 million level. You know, look at The Irishman. You know,
it's
these insane budgets. But if somebody's telling a movie from a point of view, that's all that matters, you know?
I saw Waves last night and I was heartbroken because, again, it's making it onto my films of the year. So it's like another independent, cool, hipster film. I'm like, God damn it. Like, it's knocked all the superhero films out. I love a superhero film, but it's hard to maintain that. So is it a conscious thing to go about casting people who you want to adjust the viewing public's perception of? Because Robert Pattinson as well in Good Time was another one where, and again, it's why Good Time and High Life this year are the two things that have made me seemed to be the one person who wasn't annoyed when he was cast as Batman. I was like, no, he's amazing. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be perfect. Yeah. So is that a conscious thing for you guys to go, right, let's try and push the boundaries of what
Well, you want to push the boundaries with anyone you work with, whether it's their first movie or their 100th movie. You know, you just kind of want to work with people's personas and get into who they are or who they can reflect in a weird way. But, you know, with Rob, you know, it was we met him and we were planning on making this movie when we met him and he wanted to work together and we said, hey, I'm sorry, there's no role for you in this movie we're trying to do. But when we met him, you know, I was reading Executioner's Song and watching a lot of episodes of Cops and there was an idea in the back of our heads that we wanted to do, but it wasn't the next film. And then when we met him, he came in and he kind of came in like a guy on the run, like someone who's running away.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had this furtive quality to him and it just, you know, you could immediately see him as a guy on the run.
Yeah. Well,
so you try to write to parts of people's personalities that in the case of Sandler, I think this movie is very much in his wheelhouse. You know, I think that he's, you know, very much in the tradition of Rodney Dangerfield. He's you know, a classic 20th century Jew in that regard. But he's, you know, like kind of trying to make people laugh and wearing with pride. But you just kind of try to write to the people.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is like what I was going to say with Rob, it wasn't like we're like, oh, we're going to reinvent him. He came to us with a true sincere desire to make something new.
Yeah.
And he's like, I want to be in your world and I want to experience that. And it was amazing that he was willing to come to us and say that. So we were totally open with working with him because we saw a part of his personality that we could explore.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Sandler. He was so excited by our work that it was awesome to see him respond in that way. And we had loved him since his comedy records. You know, his comedy records are the most incredible things.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I was just – we were talking about how it's so funny how our first image of him isn't even an image. It's just the cover of his album and then the characters he played on it. So it wasn't even – it's not
right.
The movies.
Yeah.
It was these records, which were these worlds where you could imagine how he was moving and acting. But all you had was that one photo of him. One of them was him as even a kid, you know. It's amazing.
It's really interesting because it plays to something that I loved about the film as well, and that's voices.
Yes.
And not always easy to understand voices.
Yes.
It's a beautiful thing in cinema. I remember when Gaspar Noé did Enter the Void, there were numerous scenes where you couldn't fully hear what the characters were saying, but that's what life is like. And that was a beautiful thing in this.
100%.
There were some characters that I was like, what did he just like? I had such strong and weird and natural accents. I was like, am I getting all of this?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That was a beautiful thing. Is that a conscious thing to get that reality?
For
in there?
Sure. Like voices, faces, all of these things that just kind of pass by, you know, that you just see and accept.
Yeah.
But the voices in particular was a very big thing. Like there's that guy, the one Marshall. His name is Marshall in real life. But
he looks like Ronnie Dangerfield.
He looks like Ronnie Dangerfield. Yes. He's got such
the guy he pawns the ring.
Yeah, he's got such a voice. It's like almost like a Harvey Fierce.
Bubby.
And then there's Mitchell, the guy.
As soon
Larry.
As he was on screen, he was the one that gave me that note. I was like, oh, this guy.
Yeah,
like,
he's got that deep.
It feels like a casting director wouldn't necessarily cast that person.
100%, yeah.
They won't have nailed
Keith, the guy, one of the main heavies for Arno.
Yeah.
He's got that really raspy, beautiful voice, but like you can't escape that.
Yeah.
And again, it's part of people's personality, you know, and with – in this, we also wanted the overlapping dialogue because that's what happens in real life. You talk over one another. And the thing is what's amazing is we tried to then say, okay, if you're going to interject there, we try and capture it from both points of view so we'll be able to edit with it, which is even crazier. So if somebody's talking and then he says something right now while I'm talking, we're going to try and show that, even though it's so hard to actually line that up.
Yeah,
that, like, how are you in two places at once? That's not possible, you know?
Yeah. It must be a tough thing to balance the artistic and the realistic.
Yeah, exactly.
If you know what I mean, from the job point of view of editing,
exactly.
of making a film, and the reality point of view, of we want to make this real.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah, you know, you try. You know, it's from a technical standpoint by allowing a room full of extras to basically you're encouraging them to you're not only telling them to not be quiet, which is what most films do. You're actually encouraging them to speak freely and be. you know, as they would be in a jewelry store, in a small jewelry store with reverberant walls and jewelry all over the place. And you know, I don't know, if you have a quiet conversation happening, you know, that will actually make your life, Benny and Ronnie's life, very difficult in the editing process, because you're literally having people talking almost at the same volume. And, you know, what it does do for the acting, though, for the actors, is it makes their private interaction actually feel private, which is is what you kind of want. You want, you just want, everything is towards the performance.
Yeah. Everything. The thing is, like, by committing to that idea from the beginning, it totally transforms what you know you're getting into it at the end. You know, you know this is what I'm gonna have to deal with. But it allows the actors so much more freedom to just be open with one another and listen. Because if I'm listening to you, if I'm waiting for you to finish what you're saying before I say my line, it changes my performance.
There's an American architect, one of the best architects ever, Louis Sullivan, and he kind of famously said, "Form follows function," and that's what we always kind of live by.
Yeah, hands down. Yeah. It's like if that's how we're going to get it, you got to do it that way.
I love it, and I love the mix as well, because there's one of my favorite directors over here is Shay Meadows, mm-hmm. and he casts a lot of non-actors, mm-hmm. and it's amazing, and you get this realness and chaotic mm-hmm. element that you can't get any other way. But what you guys do that astounds me almost even more is kind of combining actors and non-actors, and it feels like it must be an exciting thing to be part of from the actor's point of view, but equally give you that energy, because not everyone in the scene is that trained kind of, I'm waiting for my part and here's my part. They're just jumping in and stepping over each other.
Because it's like take that scene with Sandler and the jeweler. Yeah. You know, Sandler's coming in and he knows he's up against a guy who knows his shit, you know, who knows, okay, I'm not going to go in there and make a fool out of myself, so I got to really step up my game.
Yeah.
So Sandler's coming in with that energy, and this guy's now – he knows all of his stuff about jewelry, but he's never acted before. So he's now trying to perform on that level. And you have these two kind of competing things that create an interesting energy and a nice alchemy between the two of them. But yeah, the thing is the way we cast an actor, we're casting an actor who's acted before for their personality, who they are. Yeah. And that's no different than how we're casting a first time.
Yeah.
So technically they're the same thing, and you treat them as such, and it creates a cool vibe. The thing is there's a lot of – it's actually in British film, there's the acting style is always so real. You know, like Mike Lee was Alan Clark. You know, you have all these kind of insane performances. And in a way, they're messy, but it's beautiful. And I love it. You know, and there's certain things that happen in them where oh, my God, how is this? It's built into, like, you see a lot of actors acting that way. And I guess it's built into the training system of actors. I don't know. There's something different, which is really cool.
Well, it's one of the things I think I find interesting. Does it give you more confidence and freedom? How can I explain this? When you've got that guy in the jewelry shop talking like that, if that was an actor who in between scenes was like, was that okay, guys? Is this okay? And then he did that. You might say, that might be too much.
Yeah.
But as it's just him, it's like, well, no, that's the reality. Like, you've got that. Yeah. I always think when people make a film about a true life event, you don't have to have the paranoia over if your storyline is realistic, if this would really happen, if we're going too far, because it's like, that's how it fucking happened. Yeah. And it feels similar in that way. It's like, no, that guy's real.
Yeah.
Therefore, well, you know, he's not overplaying it. He's not overdoing it.
Yeah, for sure. The Coen brothers did the genius thing they did with Fargo is they just said at the beginning of the film, this is a true story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're genius writers. So they write with such specificity that when you add, I found when I was a little kid, when I would tell a lie or whatever, tell a story, and I'd see the adults kind of drifting their eyes and, oh, here comes another story. I found when I added more details, they started to think that it was true.
Yeah.
And that's true of writing in any sense. And that's what happens when you cast real people, is they're going to bring a specificity to a scene that, you know, is going to ground it. You know, it's going to direct itself in a weird way. A lot of casting is doing a lot of lifting for you, for a story, for a film, and you can't ever downplay it. It really is. I mean, I in particular with that scene that we're talking about with Sandler and the two jewelers, the pawnbrokers, you know, they we would do the scene, the first two takes, you know, we're trying to do it as scripted, but you know, and they're looking to us like, hey, can, do you mind if we change this up a little bit? And like, no, we cast you, so you can change it up a little bit. And it starts to inform Sandler's, you know, performance.
There's an amazing moment though when it's like, he's like, all right, make it quick. And like, that was in a way, that was him actually, we told him, say it quicker, you know, say it quicker. And he said, okay, make it quick. So that, but that makes it a part of his performance that he's just like getting Howard to the point. But we really wanted him to speed up the performance so we can have it in the edit.
Yeah.
And it is funny when these people.
It was also funny when you sit down and in the research, you watch these deals go down and they happen lightning fast. Yeah. You're like, wait, what? That's what done? They're just done now? So you kind of need to speed it up for the sake of the film.
Yeah. I love that. Well, I mean, speaking of casting, Julia Fox just emanates off the screen in this. Amazing. She was such a standout. And it wasn't someone I was familiar with before. No.
It's her first time.
Was that her first time? Yeah. It's amazing. She's a show stealer in the scenes that she has. How is it to find those those uncut gems in that way, who you know are going to be like, wait till people see this. How is this person not a superstar yet?
Well, it's funny because Julia is somebody who she's from New York, and I had kind of had friends in common with her, but I didn't know her, and I was admiring her from afar. And she was like a designer. She was she had this Vine channel that was amazing, that she was just posting 6-second loops of her insane lifestyle. She had all these people around her all the time, and then you know, and then she was a personality, a downtown personality, and then she would. Then she was a photographer, and then she was a painter. Then she showed up in Playboy, and then, you know, just like, but she just was kind of, you could never, and then you meet her and you thought that you knew who she was, and then she would say something that would totally surprise you. Yeah. And then she would, and then, or she'd play a song for you that all of a sudden you would be, you would never, had never heard, listened to that song before, but
totally
listening to it through her ears was different. And, you know, she's somebody who in 2014, I sent her the script. Wow. And that was already 4 years into the process. And she really responded to Heaven Knows What. So we became friendly. And then she read the script. I remember I was in L.A. and I met up with her and I talked with her about the script. And her first question was, are you spying on me? Because she couldn't believe how similar she was to the character.
Oh, wow.
And that's just, you know, that just speaks to, I don't know, the fate of a project. And then from then on, you know, the 4 or 5 years in between that moment and her being in the movie, she became such an integral part to the writing process. Whenever I would get stuck, I would call her and I would talk to her. I'd say, well, what would you do in a scenario like this? What would this character do? We talked about this character being somebody who is constantly usurping people's perception of who they are and how she's using, you know, people's judgments on that character to kind of get what she needs and what she wants, and how her and Howard are a match made. She likes to say match made in hell. She was very helpful, and you know, the tattoo scene was literally straight from her. I can't take credit for that. I asked her, what would you do in a scenario to hit reset on the relationship? She goes, I get a tattoo for him. Just like,
I love it. Cause it's really interesting to hear that as part of the writing process, because it shines through in all three of the films I've seen from you guys. Is there's not the traditional introduction, fall, and then rise. Mm-hmm. There's many rises and many falls, and it's not the traditional structures, because life isn't the traditional structures.
Sure,
there's many opportunities. Uncut Gems is a prime example. There's many opportunities for redemption.
Yes.
And there's so many times that opportunity, you're like, yes, it's there. And it's like, nah, let's fuck that off and continue to go in that direction.
Yeah.
And that is real life. And and so, again, on a story like this that's so huge and ludicrous in ways, like it's like the stakes are insane.
Of course,
it feels real because it's like, this is the way it's gone.
That was something that we had to kind of battle with, the stakes element of it, because on Good Time the stakes were really low, but they became very high in their kind of in their lowness, you know, the grandeur. But this was, and specifically with Ronnie Bronstein, who we wrote the script with and who edits the movie with Benny, and you know, he. You know, he was incapable of seeing numerologically, at least, like, well, it was too unrealistic for him to think of numbers, like 100,000, too much, it's too much, should be less. I was like, no, this man deals in units that we don't understand as as humans. He's just that's what makes him larger than life, and that's but you know that's what was interesting about the world. That's why we knew we needed a bigger budget, because it's a materialist world, it's an expensive world. That's why we needed movie stars and things like that. But in addition to that, we needed a movie star because Sandler's character Howard is a star in the Diamond District, so you need a star to kind of show that stardom.
No, I was just thinking about it. Like, if you have a moment where this Howard does something that you wouldn't believe he does.
Yeah.
You have to believe, like, the work you need to do as a filmmaker is get the audience to believe that, of course, he wouldn't do that, you know, so that he doesn't make that decision. It's believable because it would be unbelievable if it was the opposite way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fascinating because, as you said, though, the stakes become realistic in the minutiae, in those small scenes where a deal is made in 10 seconds, as you were saying, that you'd like, I would think this would be negotiated for weeks because it's huge amounts, but that's their world. It's like, these are small stakes. This is it. Even just though like
that, for sure.
he's on the edge of losing everything, it's still, well, 20,000, 40,000, 50,000.
That's what's so, that was what's
he just
so
gives away the stone that he spent a year trying to get. It's worth $1 million in his mind. He gives it away.
That's the beauty of the Diamond District in New York, is that, you know, that was something I came across all the time in my research, is just seeing people do these deals, such high stake deals and handshakes, you know.
There's barely any like paper. It's all word based, which is insane.
They memo it.
They memo, yeah, of course, but it's still. A lot of the times, like, it's total trust, you know?
I love that. Another thing that's popped up a few times with you guys is, I mean, I want to talk about the music in general, but working with musicians as well. So Necro jumped out on screen as soon as I saw him in Good Time and in Heaven Knows What. And he's amazing in that as well. But then
I love Necro. Yeah,
the weekend in this was fantastic. It's more. I've seen it described as a cameo. I've heard it described. It's more than a cameo.
His character is a presence in the movie too. Yeah, you meet him early on, and then he comes back. Yeah,
exactly that. It's a constant presence. It's reference, and then he has these moments that are key moments.
Yes.
How is that kind of? And what's the motivation there? Is it people that you're kind of either a fan of or familiar with, and you're like, well, this would work perfectly?
Well, Necro was you know, somebody who I remember when I saw I Need Drugs, a video for the first time, I didn't know what I was looking at. And just musically, he's just a unique original. So, you know, he just fit into those worlds really well.
Yeah.
And this world in particular, you know, like, you know, I remember seeing Eliante or Aviani's piece for The Weeknd when he first started popping. He did Low Life for Life, a big, huge diamond pendant, and it was massive.
The Trap House, too.
It was just, well, that was the Migos.
But Weeknd's
piece that they did, Low Life for Life, was just like, it was huge. It was just like, it was a real statement piece in the bling world. And, you know, he's somebody who, you know, it came to us, you know, he saw Heaven Knows What, responded to that. We had a little bit of a, you know, communication going. And then after Good Time, we just became friends and we started to watch movies together and started to talk about movies and share. And then he would share music with us it's always great to work with your friends, you know, he, you know, when we landed on 2012, for a while, the movie was going to be contemporary when it was a contemporary basketball player. But, when it went back to 2012, it was exciting because we were like, oh, we're going to bring back The Weeknd's hairstyle from 2012. You know, me and Neil did the hair, and she did an amazing job recreating that hairstyle. But it was like, it was not easy to do that. But the second he put that hair on, he became the punk that he was in 2012. And it was amazing that he wanted to portray himself as the punk that he was when he was more anonymous and mysterious. So it was cool that he was like, yeah, I'm down to, you know, as you see in the movie, do the scenes that he does.
How important is New York as a character in your stories and storytelling? I always describe, last time I was out there, I was chatting with Jean Grey, and I had one walk before this podcast that I felt described New York, and the walk started feeling like a Nas video. And then it halfway through it became a Matashahu video, and by the end it was a Yeah's video, and that was the beauty of that. I mean, was of the course. Beauty of a 40-minute walk in New York, that I could go through all these things. How key is that as part of the stories that you tell across your films?
Well, these movies happen to take place in New York, and then I guess for us it's a matter of getting the city on the screen in the way that we feel it. So it's our home, and we know the energy, and like you said, you can see so much stuff on one walk. You get on the train and you see all these faces and all these ideas. And it's just very invigorating. And so we don't close down streets when we shoot. You know, we keep it open. So we have a lot. There's a lot of extras that are going through and pretending like there isn't a movie going on. And we have PAs that are there that are making sure that, I guess, actors are kind of covered by a bubble. But they're also going up to people looking at the camera and saying, hey, by the way, where's the subway? Like, and to get them distracted and look away.
Amazing.
And so we're doing all this stuff. But at the same time, we want to keep it open so that you have that feeling. You aren't also – the moment you put – it's like when you build a, like when you build a dam at a river. If you start putting these blocks, all you're going to get is a bunch of water rushing towards that and eventually breaking through. Because whenever anybody goes to stop me on the street while they're filming, I get so upset. Even though I'm the last person who should be upset, I should totally want to listen and be like, oh, I totally get it. This is the production. I'll let you do what you need to do. But I know, and like in my sense, the frustration builds up and it breeds into the neighborhood. Whereas if you keep it open, you just let people just go about their day, what are they going to do? They'll look at the camera once and then you're on. You can edit around that, or you're probably not even going to notice it. So you let that happen, and then it breeds this kind of goodwill throughout the neighborhood, and you get to capture real people and real things that are happening in that area.
So. Yeah, at one point a guy walks through our frame holding a bolt cutters. Yeah. I don't know, he's some custodian who worked in the building, and having that guy walk through your frame in that moment I could never think about that. We try to. You try to sit there. You go into a restaurant. You write down the demographic of the people to try to recreate with the extras. But then you get those extras. He's like, doesn't feel like it did when I saw it in real life.
Yeah.
And you even get specific with extras like, oh, I think someone should have a cast, or someone should be on crutches. And, you know, and but, you know, you got to be willing and embracing of the of the energy of the street, because it'll help you, and if you push it out, it'll come back to bite you in the ass. But you know, look, I think the reality is that we have the luxury of we've had the luxury of making a bunch of movies now in New York. I want to make movies elsewhere too, but the reality is that we have just basically this this research, you could call it research. If we went to another place, we'd have to go and do the research. I wrote a screenplay that takes place in LA, and you know, I've been to LA a bunch, but I wrote it in neighborhoods I'd never been to before, and I was literally just on Google Street, just going around, and it felt, you know, I was like, okay, I'll do this for now, but at some point we're going to have to actually go and experience this and do the proper research. But that's what we have to gain with making movies in New York, is we have all this kind of implied knowledge and you know, or banked research.
You've got a lifetime of research.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing everyone always says that for musicians, the first album is – you've had your life to write it.
Yeah.
Your second album, you've had a year
exactly.
or 2 years well, coming. It's that, it's that difference.
Well, you look at All Things Must Pass. I can't feel so bad.
Yeah, yeah.
That was like the first record of all of the stuff that he had been compiling while being angry at the Beatles for not letting him put it out there. And I think he put too much.
Yeah.
He does a double record set, you know, and George Harrison just put it all out there. I still love the later stuff too,
of
but
course.
It's just funny how that happened there. He's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love – what you said there about the guy just walking past with the bolt cutters, because it's something I'm obsessed with in acting, that no matter how small you are in a scene, in the real world, you're the lead.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all the lead in our own film. So every person in the background isn't a background person. That guy has got such a story behind the bolt cutters, from where he got them to where he's going.
But we spend time on – we spend so much time sometimes on – it's kind of crazy. Some people might say it's a waste of energy on casting someone who has one line, you know. And
but waiter in that one scene.
Yeah, there's a waiter in a scene that Sandler asks, where's – Mike Francesa's character, and he says, oh, he's in the back. That guy, we did two auditions with him. I mean, it was for a role that got cut, but then we carried it over, and that work goes into it, and you kind of know that person's personal history. Our casting director in New York, Jennifer Vendetti, did a 40-minute interview with him where you're actually just engaged and listening to this great story of this guy. But, you know, like the guy who plays Kevin Garnett's bodyguard, you know, he didn't have that many lines in the script, but he's in a lot of the movie. He's anytime Kevin's there, he's there too, basically. And his name is Sean. He's an actor. And I said to him, and this is a scene where Kevin's character gets locked into the vestibule. And I went up to this guy before, and I just realized he's going to be in this vestibule the whole time. And we could just let him respond to what's happening. Mm-hmm. But the direction I thought was important for him in that moment was to tell him that your character's claustrophobic. You're a big guy. You're stuck in this thing and you're claustrophobic. And right when his character realizes he's locked in there, he comes in and interjects in the scene. He improvises and he goes, I'm claustrophobic. But it's very memorable moment in the movie.
We go in and he's so empowered to feel that. Like the thing is it's funny. I watch him even in the auction scene. And when Kevin makes the bid, he does this. He's really just responding to everything. But again, we want to create that feeling where everybody is important. You know, everybody is the center of their own universe.
I love
they
it.
Say.
And, I mean, I couldn't relate more to that. I've just been – my mates have been laughing at me because I've just been cast in this film, which isn't announced yet. But I've got one line and I've just booked – two sessions in with my acting coach who taught Tom Hardy and Michael Fassbender, like this amazing guy. But I'm like, but I want the other people in this film are amazing.
Yeah.
I want to get this one line. I want it to be everything. And it seems everyone was like, it's one line. Like you've told me the line. I've heard you say it. You can say it.
Yeah.
Go and say it. But still, it's that nice, fucking wicked though.
Yeah,
how cool is it to be involved in this kind
of
thing?
Of course. Yeah. Be careful though, because you can get the, there's an episode in Seinfeld where Kramer gets cast in a Woody Allen movie, and he just keeps practicing the line. He ends up overdoing it.
Yeah, the words no longer mean anything. Yeah.
I had that happen. It was like I went in for some. It was an audition. I forget for what it was for. It might have been for The Irishman. Mm-hmm. For something, I went in. They gave me it's like one line in the script, and I went crazy trying to do like this whole thing on the one line. And then when I got in there, I'm like, oh yeah, so just like. The thing was just go for it. Like, let's just riff on this thing. I was like, oh. It's like, I didn't know I could just.
I've prepared it. I've totally
destroyed my ability to even go off of that. So,
man, it's such a weird balance. Well, I mean, we've talked about sound and music and all of that being key to getting the tension across. Mm-hmm. How does it feel, or how do you feel about the current kind of the battle between cinema and streaming? I mean, this is a Netflix film, and I think Netflix and Amazon are making some of the best films I've seen this year. But I do also love the cinema love the sound systems.
Yeah.
People often think it's about the size of the screen. It's the sound systems as much as anything, and that's a
I love the fact that you're mentioning that, because the sound systems are the things that you can't. Yeah, 4K projector is awesome, but the sound system is what makes it futuristic. Atmos sound or 7.1. And, you know,
you can get a big TV at home now with really good picture.
But like really immersive sound with in a room. And also, it's the people around you, too. Mm-hmm. In the UK, it'll have a theatrical distribution before it hits Netflix. But, you know, Netflix and A24 are the studios that are out there right now who are supporting filmmakers, you know, just completely and believing in the vision and standing by the vision and not interfering.
And the thing is, but like,
I mean, look at what Netflix did with Scorsese. I mean, that's unbelievable.
This is actually something
This is something that
it's like you say, the sound is very important. One of the deliverables for Netflix is an Atmos mix, which we would never have done for this movie. We wouldn't have done it.
Right,
but it was a requirement. So we go into our mix and we start learning what Atmos actually is. And you realize, oh my God, there's all these channels. Each one is its own individual channel. And there's ones in the ceiling, and the fidelity in each speaker is insane. So you could start playing with sound in a way that we would have – like it was so amazing to us. It was a totally new tool.
Yeah.
And we went crazy with the Atmos. Like it's like the one of the mixer, Skip Livesay, is like an incredible mixer. And
he did incredible work on Roma and Gravity and all the Coen brothers.
And so the way he actually described it was unbelievable to hear. He said it's like documentary Atmos sphere. And it was like that was an amazing thing for me. And the idea that Netflix is proponent, that's one of their things. They're pushing that out there.
I love
so much so that your phone now has Atmos. And everybody's like, oh, you can't really have Atmos on your phone. If you pull up Roma, that wave scene on your phone, I swear it does a crazy thing where it actually feels – so it's kind of incredible that they are using the I guess the breadth of availability to increase the watching experience. People are trying to get better TVs and do that stuff. So it is cool.
But. I love that. I mean, there's obviously so much I want to talk about, but we've got a limited amount of time. But one thing that was – the top of my list that we have to discuss is movement, because I think it's so key to the three films of your guys I've seen. There's the constant movement towards or away from something. It's Laban and Malgram and all these all speak about that, and it's so constantly engaging, and none more so than in Uncut Gems. It always feels as if
wherever the character on screen is either going to or coming from, the most important thing in their life at that moment. And then the next thing is the most important thing in their life. And that translates into the viewer. Uh-huh. I've never been a diamond trader or all these kind of things. Yeah, I could relate completely because of that movement. Is that important to you?
Yeah, I mean, you try. Movies are cool because you get to, you know, create the simulacra of presence. You know, be present with someone else, and we've told a couple of epic stories in the sense that the smallest things have a lot of weight behind them, and I'm happy to hear that that's translating because. I believe that, in particularly in both Gems and Good Time, you know, we have, you know, you have these characters who are, in the midst of something very important.
And the movement of the cameras is always tied to the character's state of mind, like where they are. You know, when you're in the showroom, it's wheeling and dealing, it's Steadicam, it's Dolly.
Well, one of the things I've noticed as well is that you're quite happy to sit away from the characters a bit and set back and allow them to move and not necessarily rely on your close-up, your close-up. Is that again, a conscious thing to kind of allow you to be an onlooker rather than...
For sure. I mean, again, it's a form follows function. We want the actors to feel like they have the freedom to do what they want to do, and we'll always try to adapt to their movements.
Yeah.
And, we end up... I've always just found a comfortable point of view and being far away with an introspective lens, so...
Yeah. There are times where a character will... like position their body in the wrong way, and if their performance is best in that take, you have to recognize that and get the shot from the other point of view, you know, and catch it and be able to adapt to all that kind of movement. Yeah,
I love that. So just to wrap things up, what's ahead? I love the beautiful mess of the film industry that this project was probably the project before the last project, but then became the project after the last project. Yeah. Is there any plan on what's ahead, or are you focused
we're focused right now on this movie. It took 10 years to get it done, so it's just kind of just like accepting that. But there's a handful of projects. There's one that's probably will be most likely be a more North Star project where we'll work towards it. So that won't be the next one. And there's another one that we might be doing next. We're a little unsure.
It constantly
right now.
Shifts. You know, you never know.
There's a handful. For my own sanity, I need to have a couple of worlds that I'm thinking within.
And how do you find transferring from them? Because as a writer as well, that's one of the things I found maddest was I had a script that was got signed by the production company, was all good to go, and then hit walls. It's like, right, I need to jump into another world, but then I need to be able to mentally be able to jump back into that. I can't exit that world too much because if that starts going again, I need to be able to return.
That was
to
the
it.
Case with Uncut Gems. It was,
worlds are kind of somehow related.
Let's keep a foot in it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's why all the films we made since 2010 are all kind of related to Gems. So so that's the interesting place we're in right now. It's like, okay, well, what is the thing that we're going to – what's going to be the meta project and what's going to be the next one? You know what I mean?
I love it because it's such a beautiful thing because it's amazing to hear because it feels like Gems couldn't have come out the way it was if it wasn't for the last few films. But then it's beautiful to know that it was the original plan.
And the other
films kind of out of your control have happened and then made
this
better than it would have ever been.
Totally.
You know what I mean?
That's it. We needed them to know how to make this for sure.
I love that. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been
thank
a
you
pleasure.
For having us. Amazing.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was the Safdie Brothers. Intros and outros I'm keeping nice and short because, I just think the content speaks for itself on this one. Next week, I'm joined by Rosie Marcel, fantastic actress and dear friend of mine. And she gives us a hell of an exclusive. The reason I've not mentioned what was next is because we almost had to push it back because we didn't have clearance to give the exclusive, but we've now had clearance, so that'll be out next week. But yeah, thank you for tuning in. As I said, catch Uncut Gems in the cinema if you can. It's amazing. But it's on Netflix January 31st as well. But really, it's a cinema experience, I promise you. I will see you next week. Ta-ta.
Hey, Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.